You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 214.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Some days in The Local Maximum, we do kind of in-depth reporting. I don't think this is going to be one of those days. This is more like another 1 a.m. conversation. What would you say, Aaron?
I think it is quite literally. Well, we're approaching that.
We're approaching 1 a.m. It's what's today's date? February 20th, early morning on the 25th.
Yeah, I was going to say, we got to timestamp this because the discussion topic today is a highly dynamic situation.
Well, yeah. I heard you were coming over today. It's going to be hard not to talk about the situation in Ukraine, given that I was basically shut in here watching the news all day instead of getting work done. It was one of those days. We've had other days like that on the show before. I mean, the last one I could remember was the COVID episode. We've had a number of COVID episodes, but I think you know which one I'm talking about. the first one. I don't know if I remember what exactly we talked about, but I'm sure you remember there was one, and when you're like, that's the one where that was the only thing you could possibly talk about.
Yeah, here. I think we were trying to avoid discussing it for as long as we possibly could.
No, here it is. Episode 110. It came out on Pandemic Update, and it came out on March 16th. So I think that is... I think actually March 16th is the is considered the date that COVID began. We may have recorded a little earlier, but it was around there. And right now we have this war in Europe. We have no idea how long it's going to go on. Is this going to be something that, you know, just happens for a few weeks and then it's over? Or is this just going to drag on and it's going to be... You know, there are going to be major countries involved. And it's sort of the thing where I loved last week's conversation about consciousness and AI. I don't know if you had an opinion about it, but we could talk about that too. But it's kind of like sometimes you're kind of forced to stop generating new knowledge and that was stop talking about that kind of stuff and kind of focus on what's going on around you, I think.
Yeah, I guess for a little perspective, and it's not quite the same, but this is a little taste of what it must have felt like to be living through like the first days of World War One, when not the first days, not, you know, the Archduke is has just been assassinated, but you know, like Germans are blitzkrieging across through the lowlands of Flanders and whatnot, you know, through Belgium, and like, holy cow, are they going to be in Paris, you know, in 2 weeks, or you know, is this going to be what, four years? Is that what it ended up actually running to? So yeah, we're
at that far point more where, devastating
where we have no idea how big this could get or how quickly it'll be over. And uncertainty is in the air. And
by the way,
with the benefit of being, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away. So it's not directly impacting us in the way that folks in Europe or especially in Ukraine are seeing it right now.
I was going to say, I hate to make light of the situation, but I was going to say last time you came in here, you told me that you were old, but I didn't know you're that old. It's terrible now. People are dying already in Ukraine. And if you remember, so I think I recorded this in Ukraine, episode 78. That was my episode on Bayesian thinking, which was based on the course that I gave in Ukraine when I was there in Lviv in the summer of 2019. Now, Lviv is on the western side of Ukraine. So that's all the way toward... Well, it's all in Europe, but like the rest of Europe, I guess, you know, Hungary, and it was not even part of the Russian Empire in the 19th century as part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so that part of Ukraine is way more like there's pro-European, there's anti-Russian. And so that was the more like exactly that side, very pro-European and very, very anti-Russian, I noticed. And then I'm guessing as you go east, it gets less so. I mean, at least in terms of the election results that I've seen. But one of the things that, like, you know, there have been wars going on every once in a while. throughout history and even throughout the 21st century, throughout our lives. The reason why this one seems a little different is, first of all, Ukraine might be the small country here, but it's not that small. You know, it's not like, you know, it's how many people are in Ukraine? 40, 50 million. I almost want to say, but it's not like a poor country with that many. I mean, certainly it's poor compared to a lot of other Western European countries, but the GDP is not minuscule. They have technological capabilities, so you could have a real fight here. And Russia is not, you know, is not as powerful as the U.S., so it's more evenly matched than we've seen in the past.
Right, and yeah, there was a lot of talk in the buildup when we didn't know if this was actually going to happen or not.
44 million people in Ukraine, yeah.
Of course, Ukraine does not have the quantity that Russia can bring to bear here, but in terms of armaments, they are maybe a generation behind Russia, but they have a lot of the same equipment because not only, you know, were they being supplied from the same arsenals back when they were the Soviet Union, but I think there's been a period post-Soviet Union where they were buying from Russia. And so one of the things that was making people say, oh, it's definitely going to happen, was the Russian forces massing on the Russian side of the border. They were marking them with what they refer to as invasion stripes or invasion markings, because if both sides are driving the same tank, you want to be able to tell who's friend and who's foe.
Hmm. Yeah.
Not something that we've really had to deal with. It's certainly not at this magnitude to any of the recent conflicts that America has been involved in. Yes.
Right.
Yes. We have a habit of going to war with people who we were formerly selling arms to. But usually it's not, to the scale that I think we're seeing, you know, with both sides basically drawing from the same equipment pool.
I just look at GDP, and I know GDP is not going to match exactly as to what the military is capable of, but Russia has about 10 times the GDP of Ukraine, which is about what I would have thought. But Ukraine being on defense here, that's that's going to be a tough one. It's not like Ukraine might be a flawed state, but it's not a rogue state or a failed state like we're used to seeing under assault in the past. I feel really bad because many of the people who I met are now living through this.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of people who are at the summer school I was in, and by the way, you see now there are attacks on the Western side as well, which surprises me. Are they missile attacks or explosions? I don't know where they're coming from yet, but that's what I see on some of the map. The Russian army isn't there, but you know, maybe they have saboteurs. I don't know, people in the West, or they're throwing missiles. I couldn't really make out what the news was trying to say there.
Yeah, well, but we're in early days, so it's entirely possible that some or most of what we're learning is going to turn out to be inaccurate.
Right.
But it's the best we have to go off at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we're not here for hard hitting coverage. I might try to get someone who I know from Ukraine to call into the show, and we'll see if we can get someone who's willing to do that. It feels like we're living through something big. The 2020s are a kind of a massive decade here historically, and I hope it doesn't get as bad as it looks like it has the potential to get. That's just all I can say right now. And we're sitting here. There's really nothing we can do. I mean, nothing we as individuals can do. What can our government do? I don't know. I mean, you know, going back to energy policies that allow us to not be dependent on Russia might be a good start. But other than that, I don't know what.
Yeah, it's as much as I'm not thrilled with how our current administration has handled a lot of diplomatic things, I can't point my finger at they needed to have done X and that would have solved the problem. I don't know that there's an action we really could have taken here that would have allowed the United States to unilaterally stop the roll of this inertia here.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I could say is maybe you shouldn't look so damn incompetent, and then the Russians would think twice, but that's not a very specific ask, is that?
It's tempting to jump on the same bandwagon as I'm sure Trump is going to be flogging or is already doing, you know, pointing the situation is out of control and Biden is weak and he's doing it all wrong. And of course I would have done it better. But I don't think he's realistically able to provide any explanation for what the better is I'm not Joe Biden.
I think he said they never would have tried this with me. I would have told them, I told them, don't even think about it. But I'm sure Biden also told them, don't even think about it. But you know, after something like seeing Afghanistan and seeing the types of people they have in charge, it's kind of, I could see where Putin can feel like, these guys, who cares, you know. But there is this dynamic where I feel like if you're in Ukraine, you kind of know what you're fighting for. If you're in the Russian army, what do you think you're fighting for? I mean, like, you know, they might say, oh, we have a few people on the Western side that want to rejoin our country. But like, it doesn't seem like there's a very strong incentive there.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some talk about, that Russia has pitched this as a peacekeeping measure. And there was talk about, well, are they claiming, are they actually going as far as claiming that there's, you know, genocide of Russian nationals or the pro-Russian population happening? I think there were some hints of that, but I don't know that at this point they're actually pushing that hard on it. And it's really hard to tell what you can look at the propaganda being played on Russian television for the domestic Russian audience, but it's tough to judge how much they actually believe and how much they recognize as empty propaganda.
Right. I don't know what I'm reading. I don't know what I'm seeing, but I did see like the report that Putin said, we're going to denazify Ukraine. And the Ukrainian president was like, who's Jewish, is like, what, how could you call me a Nazi? How could I be a Nazi?
There is a right-wing movement there. I haven't done a lot of research on this, but
there may be perhaps in the government too.
Azov Battalion, which is ultra-nationalist and does have some quite Nazi-like aspects to it. And at this point, I think the Ukrainian government has no problem with getting into bed with them because they're going to oppose the Russians just as strong. But yeah, there is a little bit of tension there in that strange bedfellows. And everyone was saying that, you know, just days ago that, well, how could you align yourself with these Nazis? You have to fight against them to be anti-fascist. But
everybody's a Nazi. Then the truck drivers in Canada are not. So I don't even know what to believe.
I think we've talked before on the show about how there can be certain situations where if your choice is between a Nazi that wants to kill you and a communist that wants to kill you, you're gonna make some weird decisions. And people in Eastern Europe have. You know, last generation had to make those decisions.
But I don't think either side is Nazi or... I think that Putin wants to recreate the power of the Soviet Union. I don't think he has the ideology of communism, if that makes sense. So this is almost like a post-ism kind of war in Europe. It's not going to look like World War II.
Well, it's certainly got some nationalism going on.
It's got some nationalism, yeah. But that's like good old nationalism. That's like coming back from a long time. They're not dusting off some of these. I can see nationalism. Like, if nationalism doesn't sound like, obviously, nationalism taken to an extreme could be crazy. Is crazy, but like, I don't see these like crazy all-encompassing ideologies like communism or fascism that are at play here, which is but what we do have instead is the accusation of those things being thrown around and people looking at people like those things. So there's sort of there's very good reason to be paranoid about the Russians if you're Ukrainian right now. But I think and if you're Russian, I guess what are they telling the Russian people? Like these are Nazis, or we need to decommunize them. I think they're going with both. It's sort of like, okay, we're in the name throwing era, the name chucking. Maybe we've always have been, but it just feels more ridiculous now.
They're going in to protect an oppressed minority, which is Russian citizens in the Ukraine.
All right. Okay. So, and I know they've tried to make peace deals. I know that I read this, and I shouldn't say this. Well, whatever. We don't have we don't have a license or anything that someone can take away.
You're gonna pull us off the air.
Yeah. No. Well, so long as I caveat it with I don't really. I read something somewhere, but I don't know exactly what it was. But it was that Ukraine wanted to hold elections on the eastern side, and I don't know if those were local elections or referendum on independence. But their rule was like, we'll hold those elections, but the Russians have to withdraw their troops first. So the Russians could say like, they don't want to do it. They're not letting these places go. Whereas Ukrainians might say, look, we'll let them hold their elections, but you can't have your army bearing down on them the whole time while they're trying to vote over there. So, look, I mean, it's Putin can maybe, like, what's his goal here? Is he trying to create I would say Ukraine is like a very flawed democratic state, but it is. If I look at the last elections, it does seem like they were relatively fair. And so if you have another fair election, they're not going to vote overwhelmingly for the Russian party. So if they install a new government, it would have to be authoritarian. What?
I haven't followed the Ukrainian elections
right.
closely enough.
No, I looked
I know
it
there's
up.
Some talk about, yeah. well, you know, was the last change in presidential power, was that essentially the West overthrowing a pro-Russian government by not a straight up coup, but using our subtle influence to basically do a color revolution type thing?
Well,
I don't know if the, to say whether that's believable.
Well,
was that 2014?
That's way back in 2014, right? And so then you had Poroshenko, who was pro-Western. Then you had that election in 2019 when Zelensky won. He is, I think, considered somewhere in the middle. And so he beat Poroshenko. He's actually, I remember in Lviv, some people thought he was too pro-Russian. Apparently not pro-Russian enough.
Yeah,
but I also think he's like, he was also not exactly against joining NATO and all that stuff. So,
He's walking an interesting tightrope right now because on the one, yes, he's fully committed to fighting the Russian invasion. But all the people who he's going to for support, when Canada talks about imposing, strict sanctions and doing something very aggressive, which
like what they just did to their own people,
which doesn't do that much for him, but he still has to make the appearance of being grateful and encouraging for that because he can't be seen to kind of turn on them. He's got to try and milk that for all it's worth, which is, yeah, it's, I'm sure there are moments where he's saying you guys could do something actually effective here and you're not, and it's super frustrating, but I'm going to shake hands and smile and tweet about all the great support we're getting, even though it's maybe not empty gestures, but certainly not all that they're hoping for.
Right. All right. So I feel like this discussion is for future historians. This is probably going to be me looking back at old episodes to see what did we think about this as this was happening. Or this maybe turns out to be a non-issue, but given what I've seen today, I highly doubt that this is going to look like a non-issue in several years' time.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some interesting game theory going on and not knowing what's inside Putin's head and his generals, you know, strategy sessions. It's tough to under, to guess what their objectives and plans going into this are, but you know, how things unfold on the ground and how things unfold on the political scene could very well change what their approach and desired outcomes are here. And yeah, politics and diplomacy is, it can be a messy affair.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Again, for anyone listening who knows a lot more about this region than I do, and I know we have listeners in Ukraine, what are you doing listening to this show right now? But no, that's a good thing.
It's weird to have seen footage of Russian tanks rolling down the street in one direction and people commuting to work in the other direction. Because yes, they're at war, but also it's not everybody has bunkered down and is hiding in their basement. Maybe it's going to be more like that, after the first 24 hours. But yeah, it's some.
It's weird seeing footage of Independence Square when I have my own pictures of Independence Square from when I was there. So yeah, it is. I never would have thought that was when I was there, it was never like, oh, this is the place that's going to be. I mean, I guess if I thought about it, that was a possibility, but I've visited places like Nicaragua and Western Africa, and if someone told me when I was there, this place will erupt in civil war in a few years, I'd be like, yep, probably. I mean, no offense to those countries, but it seemed like
you could feel the tensions.
Yeah. This is pretty terrible.
Yeah, well, and we're not that far chronologically from some of the dark old days. So actually, to take this on a
let's
almost
go
total
it.
Tangent, but
yeah,
a gentleman who I knew through one of my volunteer activities recently passed away, and he was I think he was in his late 70s, early 80s. And so I was reading his obituary today, and one of the things it talked about was, when he was in college, he took a year off, and part of that time he went and traveled around Europe. He worked for 6 months and then to save up money and then spent a couple of months traveling around Europe. And one of the things he did was, he went to visit his family, because he was the son of German immigrants who came over in the 20s. So he went and visited all the family that was still in Germany. And they were in West Germany.
It's in post-war? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this was in the early 60s.
Okay, yeah.
So he went to visit them in West Germany, and he went to Berlin. And while he's there, he went to Checkpoint Charlie and crossed over into East Germany. And the thing that kind of blew my mind was the it was like one throwaway line in there. And this was 2 years before the Berlin Wall went up. And just to think that someone that I knew and had casual conversations with was in Berlin before the wall went up, but when it was divided and had the experience of seeing that stark difference, and then to have lived through kind of that escalation of the Cold War. And it's easy to think, well, that's, because we were born in the 80s and most of our recollection is really from after the wall came down, fall of the Soviet Union.
The only thing I remember about the Soviet Union was that it fell.
and all of our maps and globes were wrong for several years.
Yeah.
But yeah, that
some places had them for a bit longer than they should
have. It's ancient history for us, but there are plenty of people alive who lived through part of that. To kind of bring that back to Ukraine, internet acquaintance, who I believe he's living in France currently, but he has family in the Ukraine, family who decided yesterday, okay, let's get the grandparents and the grandkids out, and only to realize, oh, the airports are shut down and, driving out is going to be difficult. Yeah. And then the borders basically got shut down with them still there.
It's too late.
He said that for the older generation, for the grandparents, this will be the third siege of Kiev they'll have lived through.
Oh, yeah. So there have been plenty, huh?
Yeah.
And I mean...
Well, so at least one of those would have been World War II. I don't know if there was one that goes back further than that.
I was at the ravine. Let me make sure I got the name right. Babi Yar Ravine, where...
Well, I guess one of them would have been because... I mean, Russia had to conquer the Ukraine. At what point did they basically annex that?
It was part of the Soviet Union pre-war, or interwar. It was Western Ukraine, including Kiev, was in Kiev. I gotta be careful of that.
That's the other thing I've noticed in the last month is the sensitivity of the spelling, and also it was pointed out to me. I think I saw.
No, this in, when in I was the there, I tried to. I spelled it K-I-E-V to show the person at the airport where I was going, and they did not like that at all. I was just trying to get to my destination. I was not trying to make a pro-Russian statement or anything like that. What were you saying?
I think I saw this in the discussion when they were setting up when they were drafting one of the questions on Metaculus. But they said, don't call it the Ukraine, because the Ukraine is a province of Russia. Ukraine is an independent nation.
Right.
It's easy to slip up and miss the nuance there.
So, So again, the history that I was going through was World War I, two sides of Ukraine are fighting each other because the far western of Lviv was part of Austria-Hungary and Kiev was part of the Russian Empire. Then after interwar, the part that was part of the Russian Empire is now part of the Soviet Union, Soviet Ukraine. That's where, you know, the Holodomor takes place, all that stuff. The Lviv, the western side, is now part of interwar Poland. Then that gets taken over by Germany and the Soviet Union. They're between those two sides. And I was at the ravine Babi Yar, where the Germans came in and killed how many people? 33,771 Jews in the initial two-day massacre, and 100,000 to 150,000 later on. Prisoners. Yeah,
I don't know if we talked about it on the show or not, but I remember talking about that.
No. So that was one of the bloodiest areas of World War II, just in terms of, you know, not just in terms of fighting, but in terms of just civilian massacres. So there have been a lot of sieges, nuclear disasters. They said there was fighting in Chernobyl, which is like, sounds crazy.
I saw something about that,
Yeah.
I guess there's a city like right outside the exclusion zone there.
Right. It's also the closest point to, so Belarus is involved somehow. I don't know. Apparently, so they're a Russian ally, I guess.
I don't know if this is if Belarus actually is fielding troops or if it's just one of those you can drive right through, no problem.
Situations. I think that so Chernobyl is on the border with Belarus, but that's also the closest point on the border of Ukraine to the capital Kiev. So I think that the I think the Russians are trying to come down through that area that would be my guess. Crazy times. I don't know. I don't know what else we could talk about other than two annoying headlines in the New York Times, of which I've read most of the articles. If you want to get started, we get started. They're related. The first one, they use this whole conflict to bash cryptocurrency, because why not, right? So the article, this is one of those things where the article and the headline don't necessarily match up, but the headline is Russia could use cryptocurrency to blunt the force of U.S. sanctions. I love how the keyword is could to make it not fake news. It's just like speculative. Russian companies have many cryptocurrency tools at their disposal to evade sanctions, including a so-called digital ruble and ransomware. So notice they don't even mention Bitcoin, which is like the cryptocurrency. They're talking about other stuff, including the digital ruble, which is one of those, which is like
CBDB?
What's it called?
CBDC,
Central Bank Digital Currency. But I was going to make some quip about how it's the, What's this like? It's like related to the truly decentral cryptocurrencies, but a kind of screwed up version of it. I feel like there's a term for that, but that I could have used into a quip, but I couldn't think of it fast enough.
It makes me think of that meme. You know, we want Bitcoin, and mom says, "Well, you have Bitcoin at home," and the Bitcoin at home is this
CBDC.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about central bank digital currencies in the last couple of weeks, but most of it has been focused on Canada and given the crackdown on people who've contributed to the trucker protest funding there, some of which has been through crypto, or folks who've contributed through more traditional means, but getting their accounts locked down and maybe going to crypto. And kind of as a combination of the Emergency Powers Act that was put into place, people were talking about, well, maybe the path out of this is that they hold as much of that in place as long as they can and use it as a good excuse to switch over to a central bank digital currency. I don't think they have anywhere near the pieces in place to do that. But a lot of people were starting to talk about that. And I don't think I know anybody who is actually knowledgeable about economics who thinks that a central bank digital currency is a good thing for consumers.
Right. In this case, it's interesting that they think that the blockchain based digital currencies that we talk about on the show and that we use, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Zcash, Lightning Network is not good for getting around sanctions. I don't know why that is, but apparently they're talking about CBDCs because I feel like this technology is a double-edged sword, and New York Times is only focusing on the bad edge of the sword. Why wouldn't Russia want to use Bitcoin? They can transfer Bitcoin back and forth without having any problems. I personally transferred a bunch of Bitcoin this morning at a very low price, which was almost incredible, and it's uncensorable. What I was doing was totally legitimate, by the way, but it was just like, why wouldn't Russia want to do that? Maybe it has to do with the fact that then they lose control of their own people if they use that kind of technology. And so you have to kind of talk about that when you talk about these issues, is why are we talking about CBDC? Another one that they brought up in this article that's interesting is they mentioned this thing called Hydra, which is, I think it's illegal in Russia. That doesn't mean the government isn't using it, but it says here, illegal funds have also flowed into Russia through a dark web marketplace called Hydra. I had never heard of Hydra, which is powered by cryptocurrency and handled more than $1 billion in sales in 2020, according to Chainalysis. The platform's strict rules, sellers are allowed to liquidate cryptocurrency only through certain regional exchanges, have made it difficult for researchers to follow the money. Now, the interesting thing that I read about this is like, so unlike Silk Road, which was shut down when in 2013, I think, that's when you bought something online, probably something illegal with digital currency, and they sent it to you through the mail. In this case, this is in Russia and other Eastern European countries. Apparently, you bury the goods somewhere in the region. I don't know where that would be, in the woods maybe somewhere. And then when you buy it, they give you the coordinates so you could dig it up. That actually sounds like kind of fun. I mean,
there is the sport of geocaching. And, yes. And this sounds like it's co-opting that to some extent.
Yeah. It sounds like you're kind of like a secret agent or something like that. New York Times quotes from someone from Chainalysis, I guess. We know that there's no questions asked, and we know that Hydra operates not just throughout Eastern Europe, but throughout Western Europe, said Kim Grauer, director of research at Chainalysis. There's definitely cross-border business happening. I mean, what does that tell us? There's definitely cross-border business happening, so okay. This article fails to tell me how it seems to be hyping something up that is there's a lot of interesting stuff in this article, but there's kind of a a non-story yet type vibe to it.
I think they're maybe overplaying the burying it in the forest thing. Because you could functionally do the same thing, you know, by putting it in a locker at a bus station. Do they still have lockers at bus stations?
I don't need to buy all these drugs or anything, but I totally want to do that. Like, go into the forest and, you'd have to like drive up to some town in the middle of New Hampshire here and just like, make sure you got the coordinates right and start digging. I don't know. That just sounds like a fun. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are instances where that makes sense, but the logistics seem overly complex. Then again, if you're driven to the gray market, black market, then a lot of things that would otherwise seem ridiculous become reasonable.
Well, and I'm trying to figure out how this connects to the rest of the article, where it's like, okay, Russia is trying to get around all these sanctions and controls. Well, they have this black market that works, okay, but is there evidence that the government is using that? I wouldn't be surprised if they are, but like, again, on what scale could they do it is sort of an interesting question that I haven't read the article too closely, so maybe it even does answer in the article, but I don't think so. Okay, we have one more. From the New York Times, just because the New York Times is very easy to get worked up over these headlines. You ready for this one? I really got worked up over this headline. Fed up with Google, conspiracy theorists turn to DuckDuckGo. Now, you know that they're in the tank for Google, and they're seething with rage at this thing called DuckDuckGo, which is like, basically the enemy of all humanity is what they're trying to tell us here, is my take on it. Am I too hard on the New York Times, or am I just about right?
I don't know if I would seethe with rage over this, but
I'm not saying I'm seething with rage. I'm saying the New York Times is seething with rage over DuckDuckGo. Like, for some reason, they're just triggered by it.
I mean, look at all the things that they get triggered by. It's just added to the list. I try to make a habit. DuckDuckGo is my default search.
That's great.
Search
in my browser. But before I get to you here, I think the New York Times is trying to, like, that's what they try to do. They say like, oh, it's not socially acceptable to use DuckDuckGo. The proper people use Google, and that's sort of the message that they're trying to hammer. And it's sinister. It really is. Sorry, go ahead. With DuckDuckGo.
Well, yeah, I mean, is it that much different than pointing out that, well, Gab and Parler are full of Nazis? It's like there might be some there, but do you paint with that broad brush? I don't know.
But this is, first of all, yes, okay. No, I agree with you. They would do the same thing to Gab and Parler, especially Gab, which let's face it, at least was full of Nazis. I don't know if it is anymore. But DuckDuckGo is just a regular search engine without some of the...
Yeah, so to attempt to steel man their position, not having actually read the article...
Yeah, we're going to get into it in a little bit.
So as I understand it, DuckDuckGo is the unfiltered version of a search engine that they're doing a similar... performance to what Google is, but Google is much more curated, and certainly people may have issues with the curation. So to steel man the New York Times position, if you're not curating, then it allows all of that fake news and misinformation to maybe not rise to the top, but to be given equal billing with reputable news sources such as the New York Times.
Yeah, that's why our people got involved with Google. I don't know if I wouldn't say like New York Times and Google are necessarily collaborating. They probably are, but like it's like we have our people in Google making sure the right facts get moved to the top, and all the respectable people get their say. And if these guys are being more neutral. Neutral must be destroyed. We don't want neutral. We want only our narratives to get out there. That's
because you can't actually be. It's like there's no such thing as someone who isn't racist. You're either an anti-racist or you're a racist.
But
you can't be neutral about search results.
Yeah,
you either need to be on the side of truth or you're dirty fake news.
From that perspective, yeah. But I think that the DuckDuckGo people, from everything I've heard, are just attempting to run algorithms that are reasonable and unbiased. They're trying to tip the scales. They don't have crazed ideologues at the wheel trying to figure out what's what. Unlike maybe Google does. But if they did, then maybe I'd be like, okay, this is like a crazy site.
What I see more as the value proposition of DuckDuckGo is that they're not tailoring your results to you.
Right.
And in a way that we know Google is, that they're
collecting info said.
On you, and you know, your results on a Google search are not necessarily going to be the same as mine.
There's something to be said by for being able to see it both ways.
Yeah.
We've
had this discussion before about news sources and social media, and that in an ideal world, the consumer would be able to pick their filter or their curation right. algorithm, or get access to the raw feed.
I recently spoke about that in episode 204 when I spoke to Johnny Nelson about this with Odyssey.
But for most systems, that's not currently easily accessible, or at least not the ability to kind of swap filters easily. You can go do the same search with DuckDuckGo or with Google. I guess it's harder to do if you want to look at something like Twitter and you want to have different ways of curating the feed, or Facebook, somewhere where it's a kind of a proprietary platform. Google and DuckDuckGo are a little bit different in that they're both serving up the web, so they could conceivably be working from the same exact source material there. But
all right, I'm not going to read the whole article on the air, so to speak, but I'm going to get into it. You ready to get into some of it, and then we'll see, and then we'll basically call it a day.
Lay some fiery quotes on.
Yes,
it.
On an episode of Joe Rogan's popular podcast. New York Times does not want you to. They're already associating Joe Rogan. It's all in that. Those are no-go people. On an episode of Joe Rogan's popular podcast last year, he turned to a topic that has gripped right-wing communities and other Americans who feel skeptical about the pandemic: search engines. If I wanted to find specific cases about people who died from vaccine-related injuries, I had to go to DuckDuckGo, Mr. Rogan said, referring to the small, privacy-focused search engine. I wasn't finding them on Google. New York Times is saying, we only want you using the search engine that spies on you.
The implication being that only crazy conspiracy theorists, only paranoid people are concerned about their privacy. You've got nothing to hide, do you?
I love how they're also saying, they're not saying nobody died from vaccine-related injuries. They're just saying that it's not a legitimate thing to search for in polite society. Praise for DuckDuckGo has become a popular refrain during the pandemic among right-wing social media influencers and conspiracy theorists. So, if you want something different from Google, that's the bucket that you go into. And if somebody comes up to you and they start talking bad about Google, you know they're in that bucket.
I remember
just hate the way these things
not
are
that
written.
Long ago when everyone was singing DuckDuckGo's praises because Google is a big evil corporation and they're exploiting using your data, and that's why we should support the underdog DuckDuckGo.
Yeah.
My bingo card did not have a total inversion on that for 2022.
The other crazy inversion, and this is from 6 years ago, was all of the tech industry was up in arms about, or this is less than 6 years ago, I guess, what's it called? Net neutrality.
Right.
And they said, if we don't pass net neutrality, then these carriers are going, or what do they call it, backbone companies, are going to start censoring your political speech. And that was coming from, that was the line coming from Google, who not only do they own Google, they own YouTube too. So, I mean, that That is one of the craziest inversions of my life. They're basically accusing, they were saying, pass our legislation, otherwise someone else is going to do something horrible, which we're about to do.
I've come to the realization that most people, most companies and politicians, when they're either lobbying for or proposing a law that has to do with net neutrality, I put them in the same bucket as politicians or activists talking about laws related to sex trafficking and the like. That usually what they're doing is not what they say they're doing is not actually what the law is going to do. And the people that they say that they're trying to protect or the things they're trying to prevent are actually going to end up being more frequent or worse as a result of the law.
Well, that's a rough pill to take, because, I mean, look, if someone says that we have to do this to stop human trafficking, of course I'd immediately kind of want to do it, but
yeah. And not to get off on a tangent about that, but yeah, a lot of those, what is it, like the Sesta Fosta laws that have been brought up repeatedly, they do very little to address the stated problem and do a lot to make life worse for people who are in professions that our Puritan aesthetic may not approve of.
Mm. All right, so let's go on. We're like about 2% of the way done with the article. Some have posted screenshots showing that DuckDuckGo appears to surface more links favorable to their views than Google does, probably because Google banned those links. In addition to Mr. Rogan, who has recently been at the center of an outcry about misinformation on his podcast, the search engine has received ringing endorsements from some of the world's most downloaded conservative podcasters, including Ben Shapiro and Dan Bongino. And notice this originally was about conspiracy theorists. So now you're getting into, you know, someone like Ben Shapiro, who, say what you want, he's kind of, he gets pretty careful with the conspiracy theory stuff, I think. And
does,
so
does he not believe in the Jewish space lasers?
No. But it's sort of getting like they're trying to constrain your thought into an individual, into like a small box. And I feel like they just keep throwing more and more people that they say these are outside the box and you can't go there. And it's just it grates on me. It really does. Okay. Google is actively suppressing search results that don't acquiesce to traditional viewpoints of the left, Mr. Shapiro claimed last March. I recommend you install DuckDuckGo on your computer rather than Google to combat all this. The endorsements underscore how right-wing Americans and conspiracy theorists are shifting their online activity in response to greater moderation from tech giants like Google. They have increasingly embraced fledgling and sometimes fringe platforms like the chat app Telegram. I do like business stuff on Telegram. What are they talking about? The video streamer.
I feel like Telegram has been around for a long time.
The video streamer, Rumble, and even search engines like DuckDuckGo, seeking conditions that seem more favorable to their conspiracy theories and falsehoods. That attention. I mean, this thing goes on and on, this steaming pile. Although it's actually, I'm kind of glad they wrote it. Here's some evil Telegram user said, research, stay away from Google searches, only use DuckDuckGo, blah, 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 blah. New York Times is actually, what's funny is like, they're accurately quoting the people involved. And so in order to actually like get into the mindset that the New York Times wants you to get in, you already have to be like on board with their program. Otherwise you read this and you're like, if you have like a few inklings of independent thought, you might be like,
they quote with like scare quotes and it's not written there, but it's implicit that after, you know, they quote what someone says, the implicit part is the ooh that comes after it.
yeah, exactly. I don't know what else I'm going to find. I mean, I can literally do this all day, but I don't want to take up.
It's the context and the tone matters, because
yeah.
you can say, you know, people do your own research, and that can be a dog whistle for you know, crazy conspiracy stuff, because
don't believe
crazy
the science.
Conspiracy yeah. people say that kind of thing. Or it can be like, actually, you should go out there and you know, determine your understanding of an issue by reading things from multiple perspectives and building a logical case.
Yeah.
And it feels so trite to say, but the New York Times doesn't want you to do that. They want you to take their spoon-fed version of the facts. But it's trite because there's there's a grain of truth to it, more than a grain.
Yeah. They also mention the Dr. Robert Malone on Joe Rogan. That was the whole thing that blew up. Dr. Malone raised the discredited idea of mass formation psychosis, which describes a kind of groupthink mentality that supposedly persuaded the public to support pandemic countermeasures. I love how they put like the discredited idea in front of things, which, I mean, I don't know what to make of that, but like they won't. Like if they're talking about the Ukraine Russian war, they won't say like
alleged Ukraine Russian war.
Right. They won't say like, you know, Putin made the false statement, blah, 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 blah. They won't do it. But like if some guy's on a podcast, they'll be like this discredited fake person, you know, and they shouldn't. And by the way, they shouldn't do it. They should just quote accurately what Putin says. But it's just so ridiculous.
With counter evidence, if such counter evidence exists,
right, right. But no, they don't do that here. They just say,
if you could say, you know, discredited scientist, was it Robert Malone,
yeah,
or researcher, if there is, you know, and if they've actually been discredited, if you know, maybe if he printed a paper that turns out he falsified data and it was exposed, I would be okay with referring to him as discredited, you know, a researcher, Robert Malone. But I don't think that has happened here. I think that when they say discredited, they mean that the science is not settled on the area in which he's doing the research. There's not a, you know, 99% plus consensus on that's not how it works. And even if there was, that's not how science works.
Yeah.
It's not about what percentage of scientists say a thing. It's, you know, can you produce replicable? That's the word.
Yeah.
Replicable results based on your hypothesis. And none of that is on the table for discussion
here. I love all the pandemic measures are just going away, and the politicians are like, science changed.
I think the most recent one was talk from I don't know if it was coming from the CDC or if it was just a particular public health official saying that it's not important whether or not masks work. They provide a psychological effect that is desirable. And it's openly acknowledging that maybe not, but if it makes you think that you're doing something safe, then it's worthwhile.
Yeah. That's not, if people knew that, they wouldn't do it. Some people would. Some people are going to be masked up.
I mean, forever, but if your public health policy is, I'm going to do a placebo on the nation, I guess that's a strategy, but how long can you pull the wool over the nation's eyes?
Yeah, yeah. There's also a piece on here. I just want to point out one thing. Since 2021, Google has automatically added warning boxes stating that results are changing quickly for terms that suddenly gain popularity. So a lot of this, very wise. They put warning boxes, warning labels on certain results. Maybe that could be wise in certain circumstances, but that's been abused.
I get a kick out of, I haven't noticed too many of them in Google results, but yeah. I have seen on a YouTube video. And I think it was actually a that's recording
yeah.
of a YouTube clip. Of a YouTube clip of a comedian doing a bit about climate change, and okay. underneath it had the, like, you know, click here to learn the truth about global warming, and a link to I think it was maybe like the Wikipedia page on it or on climate change. I'm like, oh, thanks YouTube, I needed that for this
yeah.
like 2 minute bit from somebody's 60-minute comedy special. Or recently, I was scrolling through a Twitter feed with some stuff about...
So this was a comedian.
Yeah.
So they could be like, you know, that's fake news. Like,
I,
you know...
And I don't even think it was actually, like... It was a bit about, like, Fox News dads versus CNN dads.
Okay.
And in the bit, there was a mention of you know, climate change coverage. But they felt that they needed to not fact check that, but to caveat that because there was a key word in there. But
so, it's like if a comedian does a bad impression, do they then put like a little warning box like warning, so and so doesn't actually sound like this. Like, you know, it's a little infantile.
Do they put a bit on the clips from SNL with Tina Fey saying that she can see Russia from her house? Not actually,
not vice actually
presidential
sir.
Candidate. No, but so the other thing to loop it into our earlier topic, I was scrolling through Twitter and there was a post from somebody talking about some stuff going on in Ukraine today.
Yeah. That's the only thing to talk about.
And like three replies down there was the thing. It's like, you know, this post contains, I forget what the wording on it was, but basically it put it behind a button and it was like, you have to click this button to see this post because it may not be appropriate for all audiences or you know, may have disturbing content or however they worded it. And I clicked it and it was literally a picture of, it said, you know, pray for Ukraine. And it had somebody's clasped hands overlaid with the Ukrainian flag. And I don't understand what, like, are they worried that they might be triggering the pro-Russian people reading this on Twitter? What?
Yeah.
Or is it
an automated thing?
Well, it must have been. But yeah, there's something weird triggering the algorithm there.
Yeah, it's even those like warnings are a little bit
I can see if it's something with like gore.
Right.
Then yeah, okay, put that behind a click wall so that you don't inadvertently expose yourself. Or if it's got nudity, you know, you don't want to just be scrolling through and necessarily have that pop up on your screen.
Yeah, a lot of these things have legitimate uses, but they've been abused to such a degree. Yeah. And I think it will be a sigh of relief if we ever get back to something that is like, you know, trustworthy. But
a shout out for so we are not sponsored by nor have we received any money from, but I'm going to shout out for a podcast.
How do you know? You don't know where I'm getting the money from the podcast from.
But it's another podcast that I listen to that I think does great war zone reporting. This is Popular Front, hosted by Jake Hanrahan.
I'm pretty sure we don't get money from him.
He recently just did an episode talking with I think he was in Ukraine like last week.
Yeah.
He's not there anymore, but he was talking with a colleague of his who is there, you know, basically giving impressions on the ground. But he regularly talks about, you know, he does documentaries from war zones. He posts some or all of them on YouTube, but his channel is entirely demonetized. And because YouTube says, oh, you're showing, you know, violent content. Well, yeah, he's reporting from a war zone.
Right.
They don't demonetize and censor when CNN or the BBC, posts this type of material, but because he's basically an independent journalist and not a giant media corporation, they won't let him actually make any revenue through that platform, which is a weird flex on their part.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's hypocritical. It's double standards, maybe might be a better term for it. But it just shows the absurd world we're living in, and that people could write articles like this and not have any cognitive dissonance, or maybe they do. Who knows?
Yeah. But, well, I mean, it's. The question is what's the audience and what's the purpose of this article? Either they're writing to their echo chamber, to they're preaching to the choir here, or they're writing to get hate clicks from people like you who see it and are like, oh, the New York Times, you've got it all wrong. How could you be? Because
and then we link to them on the show notes page,
and hate clicks are still clicks, and that's how you make your money.
Yes. I don't think that's what's going on. I But you're right. Maybe they got me.
You can be a true believer and still go after the hate click money.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. All right. So I think we're running out of time and we've got to get you home because this is overnight right now. And there's about to be a major snowstorm here.
We're racing the weather.
Yeah. I think we're going to be locked in our homes for most of the day tomorrow. So let's call it a day. All right.
Yeah. I'll try not to doom scroll too much tomorrow.
All right. All right. But we're going to be locked in. So there might not be much else to do, but hopefully not too much. Maybe go out and play in the snow, take your kids out in the snow. Well, maybe the next day, I don't know, but, all right. All right. So that does it for this week. Next week, I don't know. We're in uncharted territory here. All right. Have a great week, everyone.
That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and their online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.